versus Gaines.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. Rod Rosenstein for the United States. Your Honors, the parties agree in this case that the result should be governed by United States versus Sprinkle, the 1997 precedent from this court. The government's position, Your Honors, is that Sprinkle should be taken by its plain terms. Sprinkle says that even assuming that there is an unlawful stop, that a new crime, an intervening crime committed by the defendant, purges the taint of that stop, and that thereafter the police are entitled to make a lawful arrest and to conduct a search incident to that arrest. Pardon me. And that's precisely what happened in this case, Your Honors. The government's position is that, I apologize, I'm out of breath from running down the hall. that the defendant, in fact, is asking for an exception to the Sprinkle rule. And that the government's position is completely consistent with Sprinkle, that having made the volitional decision to attack the officers after the stop, the defendant is then barred from invoking the exclusionary rule.
But they found the gun before he did anything.
They suspected he had the gun, Your Honor, but they didn't actually find the gun.
I don't think that's what the officer testified to.
I mean, that's that gets to be dicey, but let's assume he discovered the gun before the crime. Then the crime's committed. There's a new intervening cause. It justifies the arrest. I suppose your argument has to be that the discovery of the gun before the new cause cannot be used.
If the gun had been... Sorry, Your Honor.
And so that the gun was really seized when he was arrested and dropped out into the trunk of the car. And that the... cause from the that the discovery of the gun earlier has nothing to do with the arrest and the seizure of the gun.
Our position, Your Honor, is that the defendant's crime purges the taint of anything that happened before that. And the police conduct from that point forward needs to be judged independently of what happened previously.
My point is, though, if the discovery of the gun was an essential element of its subsequent seizure, then there may be a problem. But your argument has to be that the discovery of the gun is irrelevant, that there was a crime committed, and that during the course of the arrest for that crime, a gun fell out.
That's correct.
And they seized the gun.
Our position is that the term discovery of the gun can mean different things. And the issue is not semantics. The issue is, in reality, what happened here.
I don't understand why that would make a difference, whether they suspected it or they discovered it. It's information that could taint conduct post-crime if it has a causative effect. But I don't see, and I guess I'll post these questions to your colleague here, I don't see how the causative effect of whether it's discovered or suspected, whether that led in any way to the arrest or the seizure of the gun.
Well, we believe, Your Honor, that's consistent with what was relatively uniform case law prior to Sprinkle, with the exception of the one recent case from the First Circuit that we brought to the Court's attention last week. The uniform rule has been that there is no but-for test. That is that the issue with regard to if the defendant commits a new crime, and this is consistent with Bailey, it's consistent with Sprinkle, and many other cases cited in our brief, that once that new crime occurs, the defendant essentially has waived his right, forfeited his claim to the exclusionary rule, that any conduct the police engage in from that point forward is judged based upon the legality of that conduct without regard to the prior taint. And therefore, if they had discovered the gun, if they discovered information about the gun, if they'd done anything other than seize the gun, then the exclusionary rule would not apply. If they had seized the gun, as if the police already had the gun.
But if the tainted conduct, and we have to assume the discovery of the gun is part of the tainted conduct. If the tainted conduct gave rise to some criminal liability later, then I'm not sure it could be used. I don't see in this factual scenario, as I said, I will question your colleague here, Gaines' attorney, on what the causative stream there is. As I understand it, the intervening crime starts a new causation.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is our position. And as I understand your point, if we had charged the defendant with, for example, felon in possession of a firearm before the search, that would be tainted. That is, we didn't have proof before the search that he possessed the firearm. But after...
But he knew he had a gun before the search.
Well, Your Honors, the officers had discovered that he had something that felt like a gun. Now, it felt like a gun.
The officer testified you could clearly see it was a firearm, silver in nature and black handle.
I think you have to concede they discovered the gun. Your argument cannot rest on the distinction between whether they suspected or discovered. It's just not operational.
Let me clarify, if I may, the timeline with regard to Judge Agee's question, and that is that the officer conducted a frisk. During the course of the frisk, the officer testified that he felt what appeared to be the handle and trigger guard of a gun. He testified that the defendant then elbowed him in the face and began to flee, at which point he saw the defendant remove what appeared to be the gun. And I believe his testimony is only at that point, after he had been hit, did he actually see a gun. But even conceding that, Your Honor?
That's what the transcript says.
Your Honor, I...
Not at page, top of page 40. And that also doesn't seem to be in accord with the discussion between counsel and the district court below. Page 246. And so the gun was discovered before any action is taken by the defendant, Mr. Gaines, correct? Your assistant, U.S. attorney. I agree, Your Honor. And that dialogue is repeated several times.
Yes. And as Your Honor, we've addressed that issue in our reply brief, and in the context of the discussion, the assistant U.S. attorney was conceding that the officer had discovered the defendant appeared to be carrying a gun. But my position, Your Honor, is that even if it looked like a gun, you still don't know it's an actual firearm until you seize it, right? That is, it could be a replica. It may not be operable. When you seize it, you have it. You know what it is. But if I can make...
But when he felt it, he yelled out, gun.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And, you know, I'd like to try to make sure that we do things the same way on stuff. And I don't know why it keeps coming to my mind that we apply laws like inevitable discovery to effectuate negative results here. And yet, when this gun is patted down and when he yells out, gun, everything that needs to happen has already happened there for him to simply reach over and seize his gun. Everything is going to happen. It is inevitable. This is going to happen. And so anything that happens after this doesn't take that away. It's already there. You shouldn't have even been there in the first instance. The court's already made that determination. This is an illegal stop. And as a result of this illegal stop, you've now patted him down, you've yelled gun, and you've done everything except reach there and pick that gun up.
That's right, Your Honor. And we,
if you concede that, which you say you concede it, then you've got a problem with Sprinkle, and you've got a problem with the First Circuit case.
No, we don't believe so, and let me explain why, Your Honor. You know, as in Sprinkle, we concede for purposes of this argument that the stop was unlawful. Now, the case law, all the cases that are cited in our brief start with that premise, that some illegality has occurred. There's some primary illegality. And the issue isn't whether the police would have discovered the gun but for the defendant's intervening crime. Because if that were the case, the government would always lose these cases. That if you look at Sprinkle, for example, or King or Bailey, any of these cases, the police had completed what they intended to do, which was to complete this illegal search, they would have found the weapon. But that's not the issue in those cases, Your Honor. For example, the hypothetical that I think proves the point is, if the defendant in this case had that gun on his hip and it were a real gun, but he had another gun in his sock, the officer would have found the gun in the sock as well if he had completed the frisk. But because the defendant attacked him and fled, he never got that far. And our position is there's no distinction as a legal matter. If the rule is, as set forth in Sprinkle, that the defendant's conduct, his volitional conduct in attacking the officer, that purges the taint, then the gun in the sock and the gun in the hip are in the same circumstances. That is, he fled, he's a fleeing armed felon.
My point is that everything that occurred before the assault is irrelevant to the analysis. It's illegal, it's irrelevant, and the question now is, as a result of this assault, just taking that conduct and thereafter, was the conduct okay? And the conduct thereafter, your argument has to be, number one, he is arrested for assaulting an officer. And number two, the gun is seized as it falls out of his waistband in the car. Regardless of whether they knew it or not, it doesn't taint that, because that taint is gone. and this new causation of the arrest and the means of conducting the arrest and the search incident to the arrest recovers the gun. And I think that that's the way the case has to be analyzed and is consistent with the notion of a new intervening cause. But the fact, you know, the district court found it was discovered and said after the discovery. So, I mean, and it seems to me the officer suspected it was a gun and he yelled gun. I just don't believe you can make a case and say it wasn't discovered before. It clearly was. The principle has to be, does that make a difference?
Your Honor, we agree with you, and to address Judge Agee's point, I thought it was just important that we be clear about, you know, how we believe the record reads, and that is that he felt what appeared to be a gun. Our position is we now know it's a gun. We now know he discovered a gun. If it had turned out to be a starter pistol,
he yelled gun.
Because he thought it was a gun.
Yeah, he thought it was a gun. So now later turns out he was right.
That's
it's
exactly
like heroin. You pick it up on the street. It's white stuff, and the guy's in this package. It's in a little package and everything else. They don't know it's heroin. It's heroin, and they treat him as if it is heroin.
Yes, Your Honor. If I may address Judge Agee's point, because I wouldn't want the court to feel that I misled you about the record. Those pages the court has cited, 39 to 40, I believe, Your Honor, a close reading would reveal that the officer is talking about first conducting the frisk, at which point he felt the gun, he yells, the defendant then starts to run, and at that point the officer sees him begin to withdraw the gun. I agree with Judge Niemeyer. I don't think it matters for purposes of this court's decision, but the way we read the record, the officer didn't actually see it until after the defendant attacked him and began running. But I agree with the court, even if he had seen it, as the defendant had it in his hand and it were visible, it still wouldn't matter for this court's analysis because it's not seized until after the arrest. And our position is that Sprinkle establishes that that arrest is lawful.
But it's also seized not based on the information that they had.
That's
they
correct.
They didn't use the information to seize it.
That's right.
They seized it because it fell out of his waistband. And that which is a different causation.
That's our position, Your Honor, that that new crime, again, if it purges the taint, then the court should not create a new exception, which is our position, what the defense essentially is urging the court to establish.
We follow Camacho, which is the First Circuit case, you lose.
I believe, Your Honor, that as we argued in our 28J letter, there is a factual distinction, but
make it clear. The gun at issue here was not discovered in a search subsequent or incident to the arrest.
Yes, sir.
The gun was not discovered by a search warrant to it.
If you follow,
discovered before.
I apologize, Your Honor. If you follow that line of reasoning, I think that's consistent with what our district court said here. That is, the discovery.
That's what I mean. You lose if we follow this. That's what I'm saying.
I agree with that, Your Honor. Yes, but we believe that that case can be distinguished, and to the extent that it stands for that legal proposition, which is the same proposition the district court applied, we respectfully submit that that is inconsistent with Sprinkle. And that should not be the law for all the reasons articulated by this court in Sprinkle. That is that, you know, there are compelling policy reasons in favor of the exclusionary rule as a remedy for police misconduct, but there also are compelling policy reasons why a defendant's intervening crime should purge the taint. And once that taint is purged, then, as Judge Niemeyer suggests, all bets are off, essentially. You judge the police
now,
conduct from that point forward.
If they had seized the gun before the assault, you'd probably have a problem.
We agree. If the police already have the gun, and that, Your Honor, is our position, what the defendant was arguing in his brief was essentially that scenario, where we already had the gun, we would not be in here arguing to the court that that taint would be retroactively purged.
You probably have a taint on that violation, and you probably have a right to prosecute him for assault.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but our position is that the defendant's volitional act purges the taint on a going-forward basis, and that's all we need in this case because we're not seeking to introduce the discovery of the officer's touch of the weapon. We're seeking to introduce only the weapon that's actually found in the trunk following the lawful arrest.
So you would draw the distinction between the discovery of the gun and the seizure of the gun?
Yes, we would, Your Honor. And as we say in this case, I think if you fairly read the record.
You can only do that, I think. I don't think you can do that in all cases. You can only do that if the discovery of the gun was not essential to its seizure. In other words, if the discovery led to its seizure, I think it's tainted.
I understand the court's point.
Talking about a causation issue. The whole thing is a causation issue. The new assault is a superseding intervening cause of the crime. And the stop was illegal. The questioning is illegal. The frisking is illegal. Everything up until the point he's assaulted. Now there's a new crime, and the question is, how do the officers handle that? if the new crime doesn't depend at all on the discovery of the gun. I think you can make a pretty good case.
I think the counterexample, Your Honor, would be we would not be arguing that the possession of the gun was a new crime.
You know, I need to understand at least that fine point there, which I think is interesting. If the discovery doesn't lead to the seizure, we say they've discovered it, it's inevitable they're going to seize it. No question. At that point, if he does nothing, he's just it is going to be seized. Is that right?
Right. That's precisely right, Your Honor. That's why we believe that the issue here is the defendant.
Before he does any of these other acts, it is going to be seized. He's already discovered. He's discovered. He said, gun. He knows there's a gun there, and he's going to reach over and grab it. That's all. He's done everything except just touch that gun.
And the public policy argument here, Your Honor, would be that a defendant in that circumstance. Now, of course, this defendant had no way of knowing if the stop was lawful or not. He didn't know that until the judge made the determination. He was in a car that was stopped with a cracked window. But a defendant in this position, Your Honor, should simply allow the gun to be seized and make his argument in court. If he chooses to attack the officer, then that volitional act on his part purges the taint. And that's precisely what happened in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. The government is working on several assumptions here that are just plainly wrong. We have the district court record in which the district court said there was no finding that a new crime was committed. They keep talking about the new crime. The court never reached whether or not a new crime was committed. Under Maryland, you're allowed to resist arrest.
You don't think a new crime was committed with the assault?
I don't know, actually, because if you look at Burke and you look at Hammond, and Hammond was, you actually were on the panel in that case, the question was whether, and because under Maryland, the law is that you are allowed to use reasonable force to resist an unlawful arrest. Well, it could go either way. This was a Terry stop,
right?
This was a
Terry
stop, but...
Terry stop, it's a automobile stop.
Yes.
And the frisking was incident to the Terry stop.
The Terry stop.
Now, is there any law that says... a person who doesn't think the Terry stop's appropriate can resist?
Yes, under Maryland. Oh, no, under Maryland law, no. No. You can only...
Not under federal law?
No. You can unlawfully resist an arrest. Stop. But that's the question. But the court said they didn't need to answer the question. The government seems to be assuming that that was already decided against Mr. Gaines, but it wasn't.
I mean,
so that's important.
We would have just ma'am.
No, I'm not suggesting that it should be. And we... The government
there's so many Terry stops and there's so many investigations of crimes, and if disagreeing defendants would take the shot and say, well, I can shoot this guy, I can resist, I can...
That's...
And it seems
that's not a bone we want to pick at all. It's totally irrelevant.
Here we have a guy basically slugging an officer.
Yes.
And the question is... did he commit a crime?
Well, actually, that's not the question. And I shouldn't have even brought that up, because the question is not whether he committed a crime. The question is what happened before the alleged assault. And in this case, the government's opened with...
I do think the analysis requires a new crime. I think in the absence of a crime, the initial taint is going to bleed right on through to everything.
Not necessarily. Intervening circumstances can be something like consent, the getting of a warrant. In this case, they claim that the intervening circumstance was the new crime. But even assume that it was a new crime. It was a struggle. He resisted. That's without question.
Well,
but the government...
struggle and resist.
He did more than struggle and resist. He elbowed one officer in the face and he punched another. There's no question there.
It seems to me that, at least from the government's perspective, this issue really comes down to whether discovery is sufficient or
yes.
Does it have to be seized?
That's exactly right.
We've got two cases. We've got Sprinkle here. We've got Camacho from the First Circuit. You've got the Beauchamp case from the Fifth Circuit.
And Baldwin.
And all of them say discovery.
Yes.
And so I guess the question is, will the Fourth Circuit create something different and say, well, discovery is not enough. You've
yes.
got to actually seize it.
That's
and
exactly
again, right. I go back to the whole, I think that fairness ought to go across the board. We go out of our way to do things like inevitable discovery and good faith and things of that nature. And we've got what a common sense application would apply here, that an officer who has illegally stops someone, pats him down, finds what he thinks is a gun, yells out gun, has done everything to seize that gun.
Exactly. And the government now keeps using the word suspected to be gun. But
I want to make sure we hone in, because if that's the issue in the case, which I think it is, and that is the question is discovery sufficient or seizure, then you really, it's a matter of judicial choice. Do we choose to go one way or the other?
Okay, and I, really we say are. You go with discovery, not seizure. All the language that was cited in the brief also, look, the government talked about Fourth
let's
Amendment.
Let's get to the analysis of what we're really talking about. I mean, the facts are different in all these cases.
Not in Camacho.
Let's change the facts just to get to the principle.
Okay.
We've got an illegal stop. We've got an illegal pat down. At that point, he suspects a gun. The defendant says, look, you got me. I consent. Go ahead and search me. I've got some stuff. They then discover a gun. They then remove the gun from him. Can they use the gun?
The question is whether or not the consent was voluntary. That is Baldwin.
No, assume it's voluntary.
Okay, assuming it's voluntary, yes, you can use the gun. And if it's a voluntary consent.
What is the legal principle being applied?
That before the discovery, there was an intervening circumstance, and that was his consent. That's Baldwin, except the consent was not voluntary, and they suppressed it in that case. That was the Sixth Circuit case.
I'm assuming there is an intervening event. And now, why is an intervening event important?
Because it breaks the causation.
Okay, that's exactly what I was getting to with Mr. Rosenstein.
Yeah.
The hitting of the officers here broke the causation and theoretically purged something. Probably this taint of the stop, wouldn't you think?
I think it purges whatever happens thereafter. Well,
in other words, what happens thereafter can still be considered.
If it's not still tainted, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Now, my question is, if they didn't discover any gun before, and they arrest this guy and discover the gun thereafter, no problem, right?
Repeat the question. If
he assaults the officer?
Oh, definitely. That's Sprinkle.
They can arrest him.
We have no problem with that. That is Sprinkle.
No problem.
Yeah.
All right, so your argument is that the discovery of the gun somehow was a causation for the picking up of the gun later after he's... during his arrest.
I don't want to rely on the but-for causation because the
not
court...
for any
yes.
causation.
Okay.
In other words, it doesn't have any relationship. If it had a relationship, if the discovery of the gun led to its seizure...
It did.
It didn't. It had no causative influence at all. The gun fell out of his belt while he was being arrested onto the floor of the car. And whether it was discovered or not had nothing to do with it.
The physical seizure. Okay, correct.
Not the
I will give you
seizure,
that.
Or even the knowledge of it. In other words, it's a brand new knowledge. It's a brand new event. Whether they knew about it, whether they suspected it, whether they patted him down, had nothing to do with the guns falling out and their seizing it.
Yes.
Now, if they knew about it and then later said, hey, where's the gun? Where's the gun? And I think, searched him. Pursuant to that earlier knowledge, conducted an independent search, might be a problem because the discovery then was important to their getting the gun.
The discovery
of the gun had zero influence, causative influence.
Right.
It wasn't their knowledge of the gun that put it there, and it wasn't their knowledge of the gun that allowed them to seize it. That happened because of the circumstances of the arrest. And that's my point as to why I say it would not always be the case. Discovery can taint the subsequent seizure, so long as the causation isn't broken. But here, the discovery has no causative impact on the gun violation here.
On the gun violation, you mean the possession, or you mean the assault?
In other words, the government's finding the gun was not because they knew it was there.
Right.
The government found the gun because it happened to fall out and while he was being arrested. And whether they knew about it was irrelevant. That's my whole point. Whatever's purged before,
right.
it goes with the rest of the thing.
The government keeps focusing on the fact that we're not arguing that It's not their tactile observation. We've never claimed it was the tactile observation. It's the physical gun, clearly. But the seizure is not relevant. It's the discovery. Now, the government talked about Fourth Amendment purposes, the goal of the Fourth Amendment. The goal of the Fourth Amendment is to deter exactly this kind of fishing expedition and an illegal stop that the police officers engaged in, and to prevent the use of illegally obtained evidence. Now, obtained, Wong Sun said, the question is whether or not, assuming the illegality of the stop, which we have here, was the evidence come at by exploitation?
Let me ask you another question, hypothetical.
Okay.
We have patting down. They discover the gun mm-hmm. in his belt. They don't see it. He slugs them, runs away, takes a gun, and shoots the officer. Kills the officer with a gun, that gun. Can they use it?
Oh, yes.
Why?
Because in that case, the gun was used to assault the officer. Okay, there's, I sort of see it as a picture, okay? There's an illegal stop. There's a frisk.
They discover the gun, then.
They discover the gun, okay? Then there's a separate crime. Let's just assume that was a crime here, and then he hit
it's
them.
It's the same crime. He was running away.
He hit them. He the gun was in his belt. He uses his fist, not the gun. Okay.
He uses his fist, and okay. then he pulls out the gun and shoots the officer.
Okay, well, let me just stick with mine for a minute, okay? The gun is not an instrumentality of the new crime. The new crime under Springle and under all the other cases are, if you commit a new crime, we're not saying he should be let off the hook. He should be prosecuted for resisting arrest or assaulting the officer. If he pulls the gun out and hits the officer over the head, the gun should be admissible as evidence because it's been used. Okay, Springle was illegal stop, the frisk. He took off, he pulled the gun out, he shot at the officer. Yes, the gun should be admitted. In Wapakoneta...
What principle are you applying to come to that argument? In other words, I took you back to the causation, and you I thought you correctly answered that the reason we have this principle is that it breaks a causative chain.
Yes.
And I think the whole analysis has to be the break of the causative chain.
Yes.
So if the discovery is not in the causative chain of the possession of the gun at the time of the arrest, finding the arrest, seizing the gun, then why isn't the analysis appropriate that we look to see whether the discovery of the gun was necessary or part of the officer's seizure of the gun? If it wasn't, then it seems to me it's irrelevant. We don't need to worry about it.
Well, the discovery, at the moment of the discovery of the evidence, unlike the physical seizure, the entire tenor of the situation changes, okay? They were frisking him. As soon as they find the gun, and the district court said this at the motion hearing below, he said he wasn't going anywhere. It was done. I mean, Judge Wynn, you made that point that he was effectively under arrest. He was not supposed to go anywhere. The gun was found. It was going to be seized.
Well, it seems to me
now in
that
Springle,
crime is possessing the weapon. It's the same crime when that gun falls out. If he takes off running, turns and shoots, that's what Sprinkle calls a new crime.
That's right.
And that's the difference.
Wapakoneta is a case that the Tenth Circuit decided, and it sort of illuminates exactly what this distinction is. In that case, officers illegally entered a man's trailer home. They saw him holding a gun. Then he lifted the assault rifle and pointed it at the officers. The Tenth Circuit said that he could be prosecuted for pointing the gun at the officers because it was assault of an officer, a tribal officer, but not for possession. Because at the time they illegally entered and they saw him just holding the gun in his hand, they were illegally on the premises. They could not use the discovery of him holding the gun because it was a pre-existing crime. It wasn't a new crime. Okay, so in this case, the pre-existing crime was the possession. They found the gun on him. There's no question. And for the government to say that they suspected it is just completely disingenuous because the record, especially on pages 246 to 60, is just complete distortion, okay?
The court found it
yes.
a fact.
Yes, and it said it was an uncontested fact, and it's never been contested to this appeal. So they find the gun. The whole nature of the circumstance changes. At that point, he does, you know, if you want to assume he committed a new crime, that was not found below, but let's just go with that. He punches, he elbows, he hits, he runs. That new crime is a crime for which he could be arrested and prosecuted, and he was, I should mention, that in Maryland he was prosecuted for two counts of assault and one count of resisting arrest.
The discovery of the gun doesn't determine whether it's a new crime or an old crime. The discovery of the gun determines whether there was an illegal search or seizure of the gun. The crime was committed before the officers even got there, and so the question is, whether this seizure of the gun was a product of the illegal search. And the illegal search was illegal, give you that,
mm-hmm.
new crime, and now the gun falls out of his pocket and they seize it. And you agreed that the fact that they discovered the crime had been committed before had nothing to do with their seizing the gun. They didn't need to discover it one way or the other because the new fact that it fell out of his belt while being arrested is a new causation.
Maybe I misunderstood your question, but the physical seizure we think is completely irrelevant, okay? It's the discovery. The discovery is the cornerstone.
Well, what's the discovery got to do with it?
The discovery is the Fourth Amendment. The purpose of the Fourth Amendment is to deter, otherwise police...
Searches and seizures. And yes. The search part is illegal.
Yes.
But now the question is, just because they discovered the gun, they hadn't yet seized it, and couldn't have seized it at that point. I mean, they probably would have gotten to seizing it. But at that point, and he interrupts the whole process, you start the clock over on causation.
Well, not entirely, because let me back up a little. Okay, so you have the illegal stop, everybody understands, is illegal frisk. They find the gun, okay? At that point, the gun is tainted, period. Now, after the fact, when he resists and pushes, he can be prosecuted for those crimes. And like I said, if he pulled the gun out and did something with the gun, that might be an exception. But in this point...
Judge Niemeyer is correct insofar as the crime of possession is already going on. But I think the difference may be that possession of a weapon is actually a passive crime. It doesn't really become a crime until it's discovered. And it's the discovery of it is that the proof of it. Whereas shooting someone
is an act of crime.
You don't discover the shooting. It happens. It's
right.
An act of crime.
And
that may be the differentiating.
Talks about pre-existing crime versus new crime. And you can observe a pre-existing crime, but that doesn't mean you're committing a new crime. The new crime is what happens afterwards. And the seizure. Okay, so there's always going to be a line at which you draw. In which if there's going to be cases that fall on either side. So, you know, you can talk about, the government might want to talk about, oh, but what if you just suspect it? What if, you know, at this case it's clear he yelled gun, it was found. But the same sort of slippery analysis goes around seizure. If it had fallen out of his gun, if it had fallen out of his waistband before he fell versus fallen out of the waistband after he fell, the point is the Fourth Amendment purpose of the exclusionary rule is to prevent police officers from going and stopping people without reasonable suspicion and frisking them and then using the fruits of that to prosecute against the people in a court of law. Now, setting that aside, any crimes that he commits in their presence, he should be prosecuted for, and he was in this case. No one's been let off the hook. Under the governance scenario, the government launders the own illegality of their police officers and says that just because he committed this separate crime, everything they've done before that is just erased. And that's completely ludicrous. That gives no deference to the Fourth Amendment. It's not at all...
No, it doesn't. What it does, it eliminates everything before it as causative. In other words, it starts a new causation.
But the but-for, Hudson versus Michigan, the Supreme Court said but-for causation is not necessary.
Well, we're not talking about but-for.
Right.
We're talking about real
causation.
Yeah.
Did it come at? And actually, in this case, the district court found that the gun... flowed directly. It was one continuous flow of activity. It flowed directly from the
not discovery
initial.
Of it. They didn't use the discovery at all for any of their conduct thereafter. They didn't say, where's the gun? They didn't say, oh, let's go find the gun. What happened after the arrest is they arrest and then they search incident to arrest. They could have searched incident to, couldn't they?
Yes, yes.
And at that point, seized the gun?
Yes, and the physical seizure is after the Fourth Amendment violation here, which was the frisk and the discovery. And they never should have been there frisking him in the first place.
But that didn't taint. Well, I've made my causation point, and I don't think what I'm suggesting is altogether clear. I think this is a very difficult case.
Actually, you know, when I first looked at this, I too thought it was very difficult, and I was... you know, kind of thrown by the complexities. Well, the discovery and the seizure, we had a lot of debates in my office. Is it the discovery? Is it the seizure? The government made a good point in its brief, the only good point I think they made, which is that they usually come together.
I think causation has to be the analysis.
Okay, if you see it that way.
Everything has to be focusing on causation.
Right.
And the causation here was interrupted. The taint has no longer any causative effect to events after the arrest.
Right.
Unless there's a causative stream going through that time.
Okay. So if you apply
I'm
that...
I'm suggesting that there's no causation. The discovery of the gun has no causative impact on the gun's later seizure.
That is a different way of looking at it than this court has looked at those cases. That's not what Sprinkle...
You agree that's the underlying analysis. Every court to handle this problem is trying to get a handle. But if we keep citing each other and don't conduct the analysis, mm-hmm. we're just going to be citing formulas. At
right.
some point, we got to find out what the law is. And the theory of this whole type of jurisprudence is that the taint doesn't go forever. It's not the proximate cause of negligence. Graph, Long Island Railroad case that we learned in law school.
Mm-hmm.
It can be attenuated, drawn out, so it loses its causative force, and then
right.
you can have new. It's just like when you question somebody after a period of time.
Right.
Or it can have an intervening cause, which interrupts and starts a whole new causation chain. And so the analysis has to be conducted in some principled way. And it doesn't focus on the distinction between a search and a seizure. It focuses on whether the tainted conduct, which is the discovery of the gun, affected their seizure of the gun. And the answer is it didn't. And therefore, the taint doesn't continue because there's no causation.
Well, it did in the sense that if it wasn't for the discovery of the gun, he wouldn't have run and resisted arrest, because at that point he was effectively under arrest. That's why he was charged in Maryland with resisting arrest. At the discovery of the gun is what was the trigger for this entire thing. If the gun hadn't been found, he wouldn't have resisted. Now, I'm not saying that justifies his actions. Just he was prosecuted in Maryland for assault and resisting arrest, as he should be. Nobody gets let off the hook. And I feel like with the government's position, they're trying to let the police officers off the hook for what was just patently illegal, what they did. They were on a fishing expedition. They were a specific crime unit to investigate crime, and they saw this supposedly cracked windshield across an intersection between six different heads. I mean, it was ridiculous, okay? So
they're not that ridiculous. You know, when light hits a crack, any light in a certain
the
way,
district court...
You can, I know the district court said.
Yes.
But I think the district court was pretty harsh on these officers, because you can see a crack if the light hits it just right. You can see it a long way away.
Through tinted windows and many different hats. But we're
not any tint, it's the refraction. You
but the car had
yeah.
tint. Okay. So but whereas we have the district court opinion. So
I understand.
Yes.
And that's not being we're not monkeying with that.
Yes, yeah. Okay. So now I'm not sure what I was saying right before that. But the seizure, the stop in this case was clearly unlawful. The frisk follows was unlawful because Burton, as this court has held. And the discovery of the gun was the impetus for everything that happened afterwards. So I see my time is out, so I'm gonna stop now. But
well, I think we understand your point, and I'm not sure I understand my own point fully.
Okay.
But but I do believe the analysis we have to conduct isn't just how to apply these other circuit cases. The analysis
no.
is why did we decide Sprinkle the way we did,
and Wong's son,
and what's the underlying analysis, and then to try to apply any distinctions in the facts here. And the distinction is the discovery of the gun.
Yes.
And that is the question is how do we handle that? Do we look for a distinction between search and seizure? I don't think so. I think we have to look at the causative effect and whether the search, which was illegal,
mm-hmm.
had any causation going through the new conduct. And you sort of conceded it didn't.
I don't think I didn't mean to concede that it.
Well, I'll ask you then. That's an important question.
Okay.
How did the discovery of the gun contribute in any way to its seizure?
To its physical seizure?
Yeah.
The discovery of the gun triggered his resist, the chase, and then it falling out
oh,
of his
we
pants.
We have a new violence that taints the stop. The stop. If you take that analysis, the stop, everything's tainted. And it is tainted up until the point they commit a new crime. Now, at the point they commit a new crime, you take the guy for what he's doing. He's assaulting police officers.
If this had been more like Sprinkle and that they frisked him and they didn't find anything and then he ran, this would be a different case. But they found it, yelled gun. He, at that point, was under arrest. He then resisted. He committed, if you...
He's not under arrest until he's secured.
he was going to, he was, as Judge Wynn said, it was inevitable that he was going to be placed under arrest and the gun was going to be seized.
Well, sure, it's inevitable when he was got out of the car.
Well, actually, that's not true at all.
But I mean, the point is,
that's
we're not talking about subjective discovery. We're talking about causation of events.
Well, if that's the case, and you go back to the illegal stop, if he was going to be arrested as soon as he got out of the car, then this whole thing is complete nonsense. But
well, I think we made it clear that the discovery of the gun itself is really what you need for possession, and it's possession that is the charge we're dealing with.
Yes.
All these other charges of the assault, whatever, he is guilty as heck of those things. There's no doubt about it in terms of it, and you can
we're not
go
arguing
forward.
That. Yeah.
It's you'd only the guilty of possession, too, wouldn't you?
Well, he is, but if you do not discover it in the proper way, it may not be used in the courts of the United States. So that's a little different, and so I think that if the discovery of itself is sufficient to discover a person is possessing a gun illegal, is really all you need. You don't have to go and get it and do all the other stuff that goes with it.
If the Fourth Amendment is designed to prevent the kind of conduct that happened here, and we believe that it is, then anytime you could have police officers roaming around the neighborhoods just stopping people willy-nilly and frisking them, triggering this sort of, you know, resistance, this physical resistance, that if you don't say, take your hands off me, whatever is found then is introduced. I mean, that's...
What's the analysis that you conduct when you have the inevitable discovery rule? They would have discovered it anyway.
You have wholly independent circumstances. Yeah, they would have discovered it anyway.
That analysis focuses on the same thing I'm talking about, which is causation. Mm-hmm. What caused, what contributed to the arrest and seizure of the gun for this conduct? And I'm suggesting to you that the notice, the discovery of the gun had no contributing effect in this case. And as a consequence, you can't taint it. In other words, it was tainted. The discovery was tainted. But the inevitable discovery of it after the crime, without knowledge whether they discovered it or not, whether they discovered it or not had nothing to do with it. The gun fell out, and at that point they could seize it. Your suggestion is, I suppose,
that's the same. I mean, I don't mean to just cite cases and ask you to just follow them blindly, but Camacho, Beauchamp, and Baldwin all use the analysis that the discovery is the cornerstone for the Fourth Amendment. That at that point, police officers, that's the conduct you want to deter, is them just searching people. The privacy interest is greater than the possessory interest in the seizure.
So, but then when you end the causation of the illegality, we're talking about the illegal parts. When you purge that, the question is, what does the new crime purge?
And well,
your argument is, I thought it purges everything that goes on before the new crime.
It purges...
It eliminates the taint.
Everything that happened before the crime?
Yes.
No, it eliminates the taint for everything that happens after the crime.
No, everything after the crime is brand new. It eliminates the taint of conduct before the crime.
I think I must be misunderstanding your question, because I believe that everything happens before the new crime is
caused by the illegality, right?
The illegality of the police officer's conduct?
Yes. The illegal stop and the illegal pat down is a taint.
It's taint.
Yes. It taints conduct.
Yes.
Okay. And it makes it where you can't use that
evidence. You can't use it. Yes. The gun is
tainted. So it taints it.
Yes.
So I'm saying that taint is purged. With the
for everything going forward from the new crime, for everything going forward, and this, I just want to point again to the briefs. They talk about the privacy interest versus the possessory interest. To hammer home the point that the discovery is the primary concern here, not the seizure, is that the privacy interest in being searched is much greater than the possessory interest of the gun having been physically taken out of his possession, because the search is what violated his Fourth Amendment rights. Thank you.
Thank you. Rosenstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I take no personal offense at counsel accusing me of making a disingenuous argument, but I do want to address this issue because I think it goes directly to the point that Judge Wynn has repeatedly raised in this argument, and that is the distinction between discovery of the gun and the actual seizure of the gun. And the relevance is, Your Honor, we don't believe at all that it was inevitable that that gun was going to be seized. In fact, if the defendant had succeeded in fleeing, if he'd gotten away, then we wouldn't have the gun. All we would have is the officer saying, you know what, I felt something. It felt like a gun. When he started to run, it looked like a gun. We don't know beyond a reasonable doubt if it's a gun because we don't have it. And that's the sole point that I'm attempting to make. Clearly, he thought that the defendant was carrying a gun. That's why he yelled gun. But he didn't know for certain that it was a firearm until he actually seized it. And that's the only point that we were trying to make. And I agree, Judge Niemeyer, that it may not be relevant to the ultimate decision, but I do think that it's significant. And it relates to this other point I'd like to make, and that is the pat-down in this case. Counsel has referred to the pat-down as being illegal. The pat-down is tainted because it followed the unlawful search. But this case is different from Camacho, and this is the point I made earlier, Judge Wynn, in that in Camacho, the frisk was not justified. In this case, the district court made an express finding that the frisk was justified. That is, Officer Shetterly conducted the frisk. He was one of three officers in the car. The stop was unwarranted, and we concede that. But now you have three officers who are facing a situation that they've made the stop, and now what do? Now they're required to take the appropriate actions to defend themselves. When somebody acts suspiciously, they do what they're trained to do, and they conduct a frisk. So that frisk is tainted by virtue of the unlawful stop, but it was justified under the circumstances the officer found himself in.
You couldn't use the evidence from that search, could they?
Because it's tainted. That's correct. We agree, Your Honor. But I think it's significant that this is not a Camacho situation where the actual frisk was unlawful. And that may not, again, be relevant to the decision, but it's at least one more step removing the seizure of the gun from the unlawful activity, which was only the stop in this case. In addition, Your Honor, one other point I wanted to make, and that is that counsel has represented that she would have a different position if the gun were used in the assault on the officers by shooting. Our position is the gun was used. This is an armed felon who's attacking officers. And as the testimony establishes, Judge Agee pointed out, they saw him grabbing for his gun. And so the gun was, in fact, used. It wasn't fired, but it wasn't merely passively there. He, in fact,
was
using
it. What was the crime of him doing that? Was he charged with that?
It's not an element of the crime. But
I'm thinking that, well, you know, yeah, if he uses a gun, if he points at it, he could be charged with pointing a gun. If he shoots, he could be charged with it, but I'm trying to understand. You said used. What do you mean? How was it used against the officers?
It's not
to threaten them by grabbing for it?
It's not an element, but it's part of the crime. In other words, if you're trying that case and you're putting on the police officer to testify, well, what happened?
That's not an element of possession, which is what the problem is. It is the possession of the gun.
Right, right.
I mean, that's the only thing you're doing here, saying, hey, you know, possession is the problem. But if you want to prove all this other stuff, use and everything, you can do it.
Right.
Which normally you would think in the scheme of things that a crime such as hitting an officer, assaulting, and doing all would be far worse than possessing a gun. But, of course, we know the reality of what that means here. I don't see how he's using the gun in a way that a new crime is committed.
He's using the gun he's carrying the gun in the course of committing the new crime. And the point I'm making, Your Honor, is that counsel's conceded he could be prosecuted for assault, and she's also acknowledged he might be prosecuted for resisting arrest. Well, the officer's testifying about that incident.
Wasn't he prosecuted for those?
Yes, he was.
Well, he was. You can concede that. That's easy.
But the officer's in the course of testifying about that crime. Mm-hmm. It's relevant to their testimony he was carrying a gun. In other words, that observation is not
prove those offenses.
And that would not
to but you to do the possession, you got to go with
right.
The other evidence.
But if the gun is somehow shrouded because it's tainted, then you would have to exclude any evidence about the gun from that case as well. In other words, we believe the case law is that if the taint is purged, it's purged. It's not sort of partially purged. And one final point I'd like to make, Your Honor, that relates to that, and this is to address another point the counsel made that may or may not be relevant to the court's decision, but that is the counsel has argued that the resisting arrest is not unlawful in Maryland if it's not a lawful arrest. And I think that the counsel may be misreading the case law on that. She referenced Hammond and Shiflett, which are cited in a footnote in the defendant's brief. I believe, Your Honor, the state of the law is that the Maryland statute, the resisting arrest statute, has as an element that it be a lawful arrest. So if the arrest is unlawful, you haven't violated that statute. It doesn't give you an affirmative right to assault a police officer. And so that it would not be lawful to assault a police officer, even in the course of an unlawful arrest. And therefore, Your Honor, our position is that to the extent the court were to find that he was arrested, and we believe, and the reason we didn't address it in our brief is we believe the law is quite clear that what he was doing was resisting or fighting a frisk and not an arrest. But to the extent that became relevant, Your Honor, I just did want to flag that issue for the court, that we do not believe that there is any privilege to attack an officer in the course of an unlawful arrest. Thank you very much.
We'll come down and greet counsel and then proceed on to the next case.